Testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing.
I call the meeting to order at 7:01 p.m. and I acknowledge that we meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people and we pay our respects to their elders past and present. Everyone in attendance is advised that the audio of this General Council meeting will be recorded and will be made available on the City of Marion website. I ask whether any of the elected members wish at this stage to disclose a potential declaration of interest of items in the agenda. Councillor Pfeiffer.
Thank you, Your Worship. Look, I've got a professional relationship with one of the tenants from the EPA, so I'll jump out just in case.
Fair enough. Being no others, move on. Can I have a motion confirming the minutes of the previous meeting, please? Moved, Councillor Telfer. Seconded, Councillor Hutchinson. Thank you. All those in favour? All those against? That's carried. We must deal with an adjourned item first before turning to visitors that we have tonight. This is a motion in relation to the potential dog fight law, because we have people in attendance from the day at the Grants Commission. One idea would be to then we'll receive a deputation from the Grants Commission, and then the dogs will be helpful. That's as much as the question. So we can go ahead with that. So I'm just asking staff to point us to the page where the polls motion appears. 128. So I'll ask Mr. Is it Mr. Saul and Mr. Brzezinski to come. So, councillors will be aware from the motion in the agenda that Councillor Hullsbring put a concern about the groundwater testing in Mitchell Park and Park. So we have been calling Mr. Andrew Krasinski from the...
Tim Saul, I'm the manager of State Water Engagement at the EPA. I'm going to pass over to Andrew Krasinski. We're here to, I guess, give you a bit of a response to Councillor Hull's motion. Andrew's got a brief presentation to give, and then obviously we're here to take your questions as required. So I'll just hand over to Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Late last year, EPA completed a whole lot of work, and it was reported in the Fife report. The reason the EPA did the work, which I think is critical for people to understand, is we discovered a potential issue, health risk, in the Cloverleaf, Southern Cloverleaf Park area. We, at that time, did not know who had caused that, which organisation or company had caused that, or who had liability under the Act for that. So rather than spend time trying to find that out, what we do in these cases is EPA seeks funding from government and does the work itself or has consultants do the work for it. That's not a normal role of EPA. Okay, so EPAs are responsible for typically regulating the work of those who have caused the contamination. That's what the Act says our responsibility is. So where there's an orphan site, as was in the case late last year, we jump in and do the work ourselves and sort out the liability issues second. First and most important issue is the risk to human health. Okay, so at the end of last year, we discovered four sources of contamination. They being source 1, 2, 3, and 4, which you can see there, and source 1 liability rests with Monroe. Source 2 is a complicated issue around liability. Sources 3 and 4, Renew SA are accepting liability for. So we're happy to work with all of those parties in terms of moving on, dealing with the risks and the contamination from here, which is normal practice. We've done this on quite a few occasions. Another example is at Hendon, at the former Phillips plant there. We do a whole lot of work, we find out who has liability, and then we hand the job over to those people. What we do, though, to satisfy ourselves that this is being done properly is we enter into statutory agreements with these people, and they're on the public register, and this is called a voluntary site contamination assessment proposal. And part of that statutory agreement requires the person to do the work that we want and need done, and that is to understand the risk from the things that we don't know yet. And the other thing is to have an auditor, an independent site contamination specialist, oversee the work. And the auditor is bound by the Act, and penalties for non-compliance with the Act include imprisonment. Okay, so the auditors take their job extremely seriously, and senior professionals. Okay, so we have that gives us a high level of confidence in both the process and the outcome. So we're quite confident that whether it be Renewal or Monroe or anyone else doing the work here, they will do it according to the best possible standards, and they will do it within the timeframes that we've agreed in the statutory agreement. So what we're asking or requiring of Renewal is to assess, I'll go back, it's easier to see, whoops, assess the area to the north of Source 4 where the sign is there, because we don't know what's out there yet. Okay, we thought we would have got it all, but we haven't. So there's a little bit more to determine in terms of groundwater contamination. When we're asking Monroe to do their work to assess where the source is on their site and to assess their entire site. And in all cases, we're looking to determine the source so we can remediate or remove the source. The groundwater's another story altogether. Okay. So that's pretty much it. So Renewal, as part of their work, they've had to commit to a community engagement program, which Tim make sure is satisfactory as to the authority, to the EPA, and the auditor also sees, make sure that it's implemented, and as do we. So we're meeting with Renewal monthly. We will continue to do that. So there's quite a lot of regulatory scrutiny on this job, and indeed all jobs of this nature, where there's significant plumes that go off site. There's some examples there on the presentation that stays behind where we do the similar things. We've got thousands of contaminated sites in the state. EPA can't be doing all of them, and the Act requires the polluter pays. So we, where possible, make sure the polluter funds the assessment and or the remediation and or the community engagement. If you'd like to contact us, people have, and we've sent letters out, Tim sent a letter out to the community to say that EPA is the regulator here and will continue to be the regulator and will continue to be available. We attend Renew SA's community sessions as well, so they can contact us. We'll be at the sessions either in person or by email or by phone, or contact Renewal on their hotline. That's it from me, Mr. Mayor.
Do you gentlemen, you yourself have a problem then with Renewal SA being the lead agency?
Certainly not. As I said, from our point of view, they've engaged a reputable consultant. The auditors are accredited by EPA. We have absolute confidence in both. Renewal have entered into an agreement which we've signed, and it's a statutory agreement. I just don't see that there's any wiggle room there at all.
And look, from my perspective, I was a member of the community engagement team for the works last year. I've been retained by the EPA to ensure some continuity between that project and this project. We have cited Renewal SA's, we've approved Renewal SA's community and stakeholder engagement strategy. There's no doubt that last year we set some pretty high standards for how we would expect communities to be engaged around site contamination, and we're holding Renewal SA to those same standards. We review their we've approved their communication strategy, we review all their communications prior to them being distributed to the public, and as Andrew's mentioned, we also attend their public information sessions.
I was also on that community group, as well as was Councillor Hutchison, and I had my concerns about the way that group conducted its affairs. I remember being kicked out of a meeting. Didn't me great feel good in terms of my confidence in the process. When I say I was kicked out of the meeting, I was kicked out with a number of other people, and we stood in the car park for an hour and a half until we decided it was best to go home. The map that you had up there before troubles me. The plumes. The last map I saw, Source 3 was quite a small concern, but nonetheless a concern of the EPA's. This new map is alarming considering what we saw late last year. Source 3 is now quite a definite issue. Source 4 is new to me. The area to the north of Source 4 is another issue again, which is underneath people's homes. This issue is getting worse in terms of our perception of the problem at hand. The area is getting bigger.
Councillor Holder, this is really question time.
Yeah, well, I'd like them to acknowledge what I'm saying to be fact compared to what we last saw. I was a member of that working party. I would like some understanding of my reflection on this is reasonably accurate.
This drawing is the one that was presented as figure 4, I think, with the Fife report on the 4th of December or thereabouts. This is a photocopy from that report and put onto the screen. It's exactly the same figure as what was put up. It has not changed.
Right, well, I don't think I...
I'm happy to present or bring out council will have a record of my previous presentation, but I can absolutely guarantee the drawing has not changed. We don't have access as a PDF file.
My predominant question is, as it was for Matthew and David on 891, is that why has the EPA been pushed aside as the lead agency? Now, as far as I know, with all the other issues that you cite, the EPA has remained the statutory authority as the lead agency. I'd like to know why you've been pushed aside. Now, I phrase this question in terms of Minister Hunter's comment about the new paradigm in community consultation and community confidence. I would like to know how this new way of pushing the EPA to one side is going to help Minister Hunter's quest to have a new paradigm of anything.
We don't see that we've been pushed aside, quite the opposite. The EPA is doing its job as the regulator. We've determined who has liability. The Act says when you have a person who has liability, we can either enter into a voluntary agreement with them or issue them with orders. We've entered into a voluntary agreement with the people who have liability, statutory liability. We've not been pushed aside. We're just adopting the normal regulator's role.
Well, is this a little bit like SAPOL's homicide squad making the State Emergency Service the lead agency to do their job?
I can't talk for SAPOL. All I can say is the facts here are I can absolutely guarantee, because I've been to every meeting on this, as has Tim, we have not been pushed aside. We are executing our role as the regulator and requiring others to do the work which they have liability for.
My last question is, in terms of the new paradigm comment by the Minister, can you understand that this may be detrimental to community confidence and perception of the process?
I can acknowledge that. I think what there is, and certainly I have the same misconception, is around the role of the EPA. When I came on board last year, I thought the EPA was responsible for undertaking all assessment works. On the new paradigm question, there's no doubt that the situation last year, there was an unknown health risk, there was a high level of anxiousness in the community that did require a level of community engagement above and beyond what might be required in a standard program, and so that's what was delivered. I hope that we've built some good relationships in the community. We've tried to educate the community around site contamination and then secondarily around the role of the EPA as an environmental regulator, and I hope that's coming through in our communications, and that does give the community confidence that we are overseeing these works, we're across every element of these works, nothing proceeds without the EPA's all clear. And that people can still contact us if they want to. We've been quite clear that, if people do want to contact EPA, they can. I haven't received any inquiries since our communications went out regarding this project. And look, we do have to wait and see, I guess, but I'm quite comfortable with the community perception at the moment.
But maybe if you could try to understand what those concerns are and whether there is that justification for those concerns.
Yeah, look, I think it's probably, again, maybe not, and as I didn't have a complete understanding of the EPA's role as the regulator. So the EPA is overseeing these works. Renewal SA has accepted liability for those two sources, and therefore they're responsible to continue to investigate those sources to the point where EPA is satisfied with the outcome. What I would like to say is that they have a consultant doing the works on the ground, a specialist environmental consultant. They also have a site contamination auditor who is accredited by the EPA. This accreditation doesn't come easy. That independent EPA accredited auditor also has a team of people. The role of the auditor is to ensure that the works are undertaken to the EPA's satisfaction and that everything is reported to EPA's satisfaction. So EPA, yes, is taking a step back to an oversight role, but that is its role as the environmental regulator. Okay? Yes?
I just want to know, why has it gone to the Renewal SA? That's just curious.
Yep.
They're the landowner. Okay? They're the landowner of those source 3 and 4.
Just on the source 3 and 4, with Renewal SA taking the ownership, that's the ownership of the investigation and not of the source of the problem. And will the, the polluter be uncovered and will they be followed up?
We've had discussions with Mitsubishi and Renewal and with Monroe, okay, all three parties, all separately. There are significant legal complexities around liability, and Renewal has said it will get on with the job and deal with the financial and legal matters separately in time. Okay? So what they're saying is, and I think it's good, and that is, if this is going to play out over years of legal wrangling, they don't think that's fair on the community. Okay? The important thing is to get on with this and understand it and basically get out of the community from a continuing investigation point of view, environmental investigation, and then have the legal arguments separately, okay, in another place at another time. And I think it's admirable, I think. And see, what they've done is what we tried. The reason we did this is to avoid just that legal wrangling. We had very strong suspicions as to who it would be, okay, and we could have fought that out in court with the powers we've got, but the community would be rightly intolerant of that. Okay, so we stepped away from our normal role of regulating the people who have liability and did the work ourselves because we are the organisation that has the skills to do that. All right, and then once we have enough evidence to start saying, rightio, who has liability, we'll step back to our role as the regulator. I understand that's confusing. I absolutely understand where you're coming from. You know how this perceives to be is a sidestep or stepping back. It's not that. I know I may never be able to convince anyone of that, but it is not that. It's us allowing those who have the liability to get on with their job. Now we no longer have to do that, okay? And it would be crazy for government to be doing in any jurisdiction anywhere in the world to just take on the liability of every polluter. You know, it's just no government anywhere could afford that at any level. You know. So what the governments do is they establish EPAs and they establish legislation, typically to require other people to do it, and EPAs to regulate that.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I move the motion as printed. Mr. Mayor, move the motion as printed. The presentation has actually raised more questions and more concern than it has provided answers. I can see that there really should be a source 5 underneath the homes of Clare Valley Park, to the north of the Mitsubishi site, which is new to me. Don't know about Councillor Hutchinson, but it's new to me. I don't remember seeing that one in my time on that group. And the plumes to the west of the site seem to be worsening. Mr. Mayor, when the EPA is stepping back, they should be stepping up. This is a worsening issue for our city. We've had how many people moved out of their homes in southern Clare Valley Park? I don't know what the outcome's going to be in the north now of Clare Valley Park, but if I were those residents, I'd be concerned. And I would not be happy with the developer next door being the lead agency. Let me assure you of that. I just think that this council needs to stand up to the plate, not step back like the EPA, and actually be advocates on behalf of the community. Now, Mr. Mayor, with the Tonsley site, this council should be probably the first one to try and activate the site and see things happening on the site in disposal of land. Because every inch of land that's sold on that site, it's a net gain for the council will raise. No doubt about that. We lost our second biggest ratepayer overnight. However, this council also has a responsibility to be alert for something that may well impact on the community. like contaminated soil and groundwater. So into the future, if things don't go well with this, if we put a metre of topsoil over the site like was proposed with the other site, the hill site, and everything's sweet, and down the track, like is the case down at West Lakes, mums and dads build their homes and it all goes to crap. They realise they're living on a contaminated site. Who will the people come looking for? It'll be the council of the day knocking on their door as to, for them to explain why they actually acknowledged that there were some process issues and did nothing about it. We have to make sure that the people have the perception and a reasonable understanding that the process is appropriate. You cannot have the developer as the lead agency. To the best of my knowledge, with the hillside, with all the other sites mentioned tonight and in the report, the EPA has been the lead agency. This is really a shift from the normal. This is the EPA that has been described by many as a toothless tiger becoming a whimpering lapdog to the side. And I'm not happy with that. I'm looking for a stronger EPA in this state, not a weaker one, and I certainly expect them to do their job in the city that has so many issues with groundwater contamination, the length of South Road from Clovelly Park up to Glandore. So I just implore you, members, to actually support this motion, to object to the, make a strong objection to the Premier that this is not good enough. We want the statutory authority as the lead agency, not Renewal SA, who is a property developer. And that's my position.
To start with, what is that extra plume? Is it possible to get that extra plume on the photo, which didn't have a source, that light green one? Just wondering what that was. Are we able to ask one of the members of the EPA to answer that question?
may I just make a comment, quick comment? I do recall a very large plume like that under Mitchell Park, mainly because I actually used to live in Mitchell Park. I took note of it. So I do believe it's not really changed.
I speak against the motion. I believe that Renewal SA needs to take the lead, just like Monroe did its testing. I believe Renewal SA needs to do its testing. It needs to pass the costs on to Mitsubishi at an appropriate time. I think what's been explained to us is orderly. I think there is a problem with the EPA being both the regulator and the tester and everything else. So I'll vote against the motion.
I think it's always necessary to have a degree of scepticism, and I always do. But I think in this case it has been explained to us. There hasn't been any change in the information that was provided. The EPA is overlooking all this, and whilst it's easier to have a shot at the EPA for whatever reason, I think that we need to look at each situation on its own merits. And at this point, I'm quite comfortable with what they've done. I think particular note is we need to look at the community. It's not about making the community, stirring up fear and concern in the community when we don't have to. And what they're doing by actually looking to get to the bottom of the possible pollution, looking at that issue first instead of trying to blame someone while the community waits, I think that's a more preferable outcome. And if that's if they're the two options that we have. So I'm not going to support this motion. I don't think it's appropriate, especially after the presentation we've been given. I obviously know that Councillor Hull's heart is in the right place. He wants the community protected. He doesn't want the wall pulled over people's eyes. But at this point, in the information that I have provided, I don't feel that that is the case.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. With all the speakers that have spoken against, they keep saying we want the EPA to continue to do the job. Well, so do I. However, in the past, they've been the lead agency. And this is the point that's been missed by the speakers against the motion. The lead agency is now not the EPA. And I think that people in South Australia have had concerns about the power, the effectiveness of the EPA in the past. This is actually going to diminish the confidence in the EPA. This is not consistent with Minister Hunter's new paradigm in community consultation and instilling confidence back in the process. And I'm firmly of the view of that, Mr. Mayor. I think that this will do more harm than good in terms of community perception. What next? Do we have major developers, the lead agency, in determining their sites? This is the thin edge of the wedge. It worries me that is this going to become a trend in government policy to actually make the EPA just an observer? And as for, giving the EPA too much to do, well, come on. Most people would expect the EPA to actually be overseeing the testing, to actually be monitoring the reports, to actually be fully engaged, not on the sideline, not stepping back, as what has been said by the EPA representative, stepping back. Now, I was less than happy with that comment because, as I said before, the EPA should be stepping up, not stepping back, because this is a major issue. And, Mr. Mayor, it's not the only site. Let's digress in terms of the groundwater contamination issues in the city of Marion is significant. There's a plume from South Road, Mr. Mayor, that has probably reached Marion Road now from the former Hills site. And there's a plume also extending out considerably from the old Bridgestone site and so on and so forth. It's all the way down South Road. We really should be expecting more from the EPA and more from the government in terms of looking after the interests of this city and the people that are anxiously living on the eastern boundary
along South Road.
And thank you very much for your welcome this evening. And hang on, do I press buttons here? Is that on now? Sorry, I'm not used. Thank you. My name is Mary Petetsos. I chair the Local Government Grants Commission. Sitting in the public area at the back, I was very interested in the conversation that you've just had with the EPA. I must declare at this point that I also have another role in my working life, and that is as the chair of the South Australian Housing Trust. We're obviously an interested party in some of the matters that you've been discussing. So I do say at this stage that none of that information was news to me. But I did feel the need, given that conversation, to alert you to my other role. So be that as it may, I'm sitting here today as the chair of the Grants Commission. And welcome with me, Jane Gascoigne, and our new commissioner. We're very fortunate. I think actually Luke's one of the very few commissioners the commission has had that's actually from a metropolitan council. So we're very pleased to have Luke on our commission. And thank you very much for the council in terms of indulging Luke and declaring some spare time. I don't know how he does it with a full-time job and also his role as a councillor. So and deputy mayor, I believe. Busy man. With us here today is Peter Eiley, and he will take you through some of the technical features of what we do. I'm assuming that most of you are aware of what the Commission does. Our role is to make recommendations on the distribution of untied Commonwealth financial assistance grants to local governing authorities in South Australia. That's 68 councils, five local government-like authorities that are Aboriginal communities and the Outback Communities Authority. The grants are unique in that the grants are untied and council is free to spend the grants as they see fit. The grant consists of two components, the general financial assistance component and a road component. We're established under a South Australian Act called the South Australian Local Government Grants Act, and we distribute the grants as prescribed under the Commonwealth Local Government Financial Assistance Act. We're required under that Act to conduct visits to councils so that we can hear from councils direct what it is that interests them and so that we can actually explain to councils how the money is distributed. I must say that this has been a very peculiar time for the Commission. It's the first time in the Commission's history where, in fact, our grants are shrinking. The Commonwealth Government in 2013-14 declared that the grants would not only not receive additional funds but would, in fact, not be increased by CPI. So in real terms, the grants are decreasing, so it's something that we've had to contend with, and unfortunately for councils that's meant, of course, perhaps austerity in the way, not in the European sense, but certainly a shortfall in the distribution of money. So I'll now hand it over to Peter, and can I say that if you have questions, we're more than happy to take them. We don't think that we've got this down to a fine art, so we're more than happy to accommodate new ideas from councils and have done so in the past. And in fact, Marion Council is one of the key councils that influenced our introduction of FIFA, which Peter will explain soon. Thank you.
We're under a fairly limited time schedule tonight, so I'm going to skip fairly quickly through these slides. If at any stage you want to stop me and ask a question, please do so. If you've got questions after, you've got a copy of this presentation in your handouts tonight, and I'm sure Luke would be quite happy to help you out with any questions you've got, and if Luke needs a hand with it, he'll contact me, so please feel free. In terms of the total financial assistance grants, this table just gives you a little bit of an idea of the pool of funding that's been made available by the Commonwealth for 2014-15. I can't really talk about 15-16 yet because they haven't been approved. Those grants haven't been approved. Distribution of those grants haven't been approved by the Commonwealth Minister, but the Commissioner is in the process of undertaking that, getting that permission at the moment. So those figures will be released very soon. You can see at the bottom there a little bit over $2.2 billion will be distributed amongst the country for 2014-15. South Australia's proportion is a little bit under $153 million. In terms of the general purpose grants, so Mary talked about general purpose grants and identified local road grants. The general purpose grants, this table is the same as the first table, except it's just the general purpose grants. It shows you a little bit over $1.5 billion in general purpose grants for 2014-15. And for South Australia, a little bit over $114 million. You might notice, if you're looking at this year versus last year, that the proportion or the piece of pie that South Australia gets has reduced from 7.26% to 7.19%. And Mary alluded to that earlier in terms of South Australia. Although our population is increasing, the proportion of our population compared to the other states is decreasing. And so therefore we're receiving, and have done for many years, a slightly smaller piece of pie each year. That's been exacerbated this year, last year and next year by the fact that the Commonwealth have chosen to freeze the indexation. So grants won't go up by CPI and won't change by population, except for South Australia in terms of the loss of our population proportion means that our grants are actually going backwards, as Mary said. So for 2014-15, because of that decrease in population share, our general purpose grants went down by 0.9%, which is a little bit over $1 million in terms of the dollar figures. A little bit closer to home for Marion, your general purpose grant for 14-15 of a bit over $1.7 million, a decrease of 0.47% in terms of the share of the decrease in the pool that you've received. You've got some identified road grants of $927,000, which went up a little bit due to some road length changes for you. And you've got an adjustment for 13-14, which is an adjustment of the estimates for 2013 to 2013-14 of a little bit over $15,000. So you've got a total there of just over $2.7 million, which has all been paid to you now during the 14-15 financial year. I've got to keep up with the right year. In terms of the legislative requirements that Mary alluded to earlier, those are the six national principles. They're all explained in detail in the handouts you've gotten on this presentation. I'm going to cover the two most important ones. They're all important. They're all incorporated into the Commission's recommendations every year. But essentially, it's the first two, horizontal equalisation and the per capita minimum principles, which are around which most of the Commission's work is done. So in terms of the full horizontal equalisation principle, it's defined by the Commonwealth Act as a reference to an allocation of funds that ensures that each local governing body is able to function by reasonable effort at a standard not lower than the average standard of other local governing bodies in the state, and it takes account of the differences in the expenditure required to be incurred by councils in the performance of their functions and in their capacity to raise revenue. Essentially, the way the grant program therefore works is that the Commission, first of all, with all of the information they collect, including info out of your supplementary return and your general information return and other agencies that we collect information from, is the Commission will establish what an average level of service across the state would be based on all of that information. You can think about that as the dotted line. And then it assesses each council across that horizontal line to work out whether or not you have a greater or lesser capacity to provide services compared to that average. Obviously, there'll be some councils who are quite obviously on the lower end of the scale, councils in small regional and rural areas like Woodnair and Kimber. Those sorts of councils will generally have a lower capacity to raise revenue, they'll have lower property values, they'll have lower populations. They'll have a higher expenditure needs, they have higher kilometres of road to maintain, long distance to go to collect waste from their residents, those sorts of issues compared to the average. Those councils will generally receive more funding out of the grant process. On the flip side, you've got councils who have a high capacity to provide services, councils such as yourselves to a degree, Walkerville, Burnside. Small councils in the city like that will tend to have higher populations and higher property values, and they will, compared to the average, have a greater capacity to raise revenue, and they'll tend to, on average, have a lower expenditure need. They'll have less distance to go to collect waste, less kilometres of road to maintain, those sorts of issues. You might argue, I suppose, that councils on the right-hand side of the dotted line, so greater than average capacity, don't actually need a grant, according to the assessment process. But if you keep that in mind and then think about the second principle, which is the per capita minimum principle, that says that each council is assured of receiving as a minimum the amount to which the council would be entitled if 30% of the amount of the fund was allocated on a per capita basis. That's where you guys fit in, along with 16 other councils across the state. Okay, so you're assessed by the Commission as having a greater than average capacity to provide services, and you therefore receive the per capita minimum principle grant. I won't go over the other principles in great detail. You can have a read through them. In terms of the way in which the Commission undertakes its assessment, the Commission calculates a revenue component and an expenditure component, obviously based on a bunch of mathematical formulas. What I've done in your handouts is I've given you a couple of examples of a revenue calculation and an expenditure calculation for either side of the methodology for your information. Again, happy to go through it. At some stage, we'll provide any clarity if you've got any questions. In terms of the revenue component, it estimates the grant component based on council's capacity to provide to raise revenue compared to the average council. A number of factors are taken into consideration in that process. They include property values from the Valuer General's office. We use the same property values that you use in terms of residential, rural, industrial, commercial and other. We also use population, which we get from the Australian Bureau of Statistics each year. And we also, as Mary said, we use the CIFRA Index of Economic Resources from the ABS, which is an index used by the Commission to account for councils' relative advantage or disadvantage compared to other councils in relation to residents' capacity to pay. Five calculations are undertaken on the revenue side for each of the different property types. They're added to the calculations on the expenditure side. Again, some important factors taken into consideration on the expenditure side. Reported costs, so you provide us with essentially your operating statement broken down into functional categories so that we know exactly what you're spending and every council across the state is spending their operating budgets on each year. We also use a thing called a cost driver, which is an independent measure or a factor that drives the cost of providing a particular service but is independent of your ability to influence. So, for example, for the provision of library services to your community, the Commission used to use, because that's changed, the number of visitors to the library. In terms of aged care services that you provide, the Commission used the population of council that is over 65 years of age. In terms of waste management there, we've got the number of residential properties from which waste is collected, which has actually just been updated. We also have a thing called a cost relativity indice, which is a measure of council's relative advantage or disadvantage compared to other councils in providing similar services due to factors outside your control. An example of that is your distance of collection route for waste management. So you think about how far your council has to go to collect waste from your residents, and you think about that compared to Port Lincoln, okay, or any of the much larger councils. They've got a disadvantage, you've got an advantage, you might have a disadvantage compared to some councils, but that's what that factor does. It adjusts your expenditure grant to account for that. That's the current list of functions that are assessed on the expenditure side. There's about 19 different calculations there. Those items are represented by your operating budget. So this directly comes out of what you spend in terms of your operating expenditure each year, and it is reviewed and updated by the Commission on a regular basis based on the information you provide. So those 19 calculations on the expenditure side are added to 5 on the revenue side to get what we call your raw grant, the general purpose grant. And then that raw grant, which would be the amount to which you'd be entitled if the pool wasn't limited by the Commonwealth, is then factored back according to the amount of money that's actually being provided. That's your general purpose grants. Just quickly, your identified road grants. This table's the same as the one at the beginning. 38.66 million for South Australia for 2014-15 out of 703 million. You might notice if you're looking at last year's comparison that the proportion South Australia gets is 5.5% for both periods. In fact, it's been that way since about 1991. I'll come back to that. The identified road grants are distributed in a much simpler way. 85% is divided between urban and rural councils on the basis of an equal weighting of road length and population. In the urban area, then the same process is undertaken again, and in the rural area, the area of the council is included in the calculation. 15% of the identified road grants are put into the Special Local Roads Program, which provides funding for roads of regional significance. That program is administered by the LGTAC for the Grants Commission, receives 15% out of each of the road grant programs, so that's the identified road grant. Used to be the supplementary local road funding when South Australia got that, and the roads to recovery programs. The special local road program for 2014-15 was a little bit over $10 million across 25 projects, about 25 projects across the state. This table is meant to illustrate the issue with the proportion of funding that South Australia receives. So if you look at this table, I like to use Tasmania underneath as a bit of an example. You can see from the second column there that South Australia receives 5.5% of the pool of funding. Tasmania underneath just receives a little bit less at 5.3%. But if you look at the next two columns, the kilometres of road maintained by local government in South Australia, 77,000 versus only 14,000. And the dollar per kilometre grant that's provided, 496 versus 2,614. You can clearly see that South Australia has been unfairly treated since 1991 when that proportion was allocated. A number of things have happened over a long period of time to try to address that issue. The supplementary local road funding was in place from, I think, 03-04 to 13-14, and that provided an extra $135 million over that period. That certainly helped that situation. You'd probably be aware that the roads to recovery funding has been increased in recent years in order to provide some additional funding, but that hasn't necessarily been just directed at South Australia, that's across the whole country. So this year, your roads to recovery allocation under the current program will be double what it was last year. And the Commonwealth have just announced an additional $1.1 billion across the country that's come out of the reintroduction of the indexing of the federal fuel excise. So there's more money coming in 15-16 for roads to recovery, and that certainly will help. But that money's going to every state and to every council across Australia. That doesn't specifically address the 5.5% issue for South Australia. So that's the grant program in a very quick overview. Mary?
Thank you. Now, that was very quick because we're conscious of your timetable. We're happy to take comments or questions if there are any. Alternatively, we seem to have just been thorough.
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. Marion Council's obviously doing so well it only qualifies for the minimum in terms of our capacity to raise revenue. I do note in the tables for the financial assistance grants and general purpose grants that the winner in terms of variation seems to be Western Australia and the losers South Australia and Tasmania. Now, that has nothing to do with the marginal seats in each state, does it?
Of course not.
Oh, right. Other questions, members? Councillor Telfer.
In some ways, we as elected members are a bit a taker. There's nothing we can do. All we do is receive. Is that so? There's nothing we can change or lobby for or work towards. It just is.
It's important that your council is providing us with, or the commission, with information that allows them to make the assessment. And you do that through your supplementary return and you do that through your general information return, and those documents are very important. If elected members are interested in looking through the process that the commission undertakes, and there are obvious areas for Marion that are missing in terms of the services that you provide, then the Commissioner, always happy to hear about those. And some of those things over periods of time have led to changes to the methodology and changes to grant outcomes. Mary earlier mentioned the seat for index, and obviously Marion had some part to play in the implementation of the seat for index to recognise residents' capacity to pay within your council area. So your revenue assessments are adjusted by your CIFR index from the ABS to recognise that factor. Those sorts of things help the Commission, but ultimately it's the information that you provide and the independent information that the Commission gets from the ABS and those sorts of organisations that allow the Commission to paint a picture of where you're at compared to the average council. And that is not directly in your control, and it is intentionally so.
I saw this formula here, and I couldn't help but wonder, is that the LGA formula that works out our fee, our annual membership fee?
That's much more complicated.
The serious question is that you talked about waste management and, you know, carting rubbish long distances. Could I suggest that we're actually being penalised for actually doing a job well? We've actually got a waste management authority down at Peddlers Creek with other councils. That's been in place for a long time. Our forefathers back in the early days of the Marion Council went into a co-op down there. That's serving us well today and into the near future. If that hadn't have happened, we would be carting our rubbish up past Dublin. So, why should we be not getting the grant money for at least taking that step with infrastructure and looking to the future when maybe other councils could have done that and elected not to? You know, like, I guess that goes for a lot of things in terms of...
I mean, it's not a simple answer. You've got a point, but I guess one of the things that Jane likes to say, and I'll maybe let her speak if she wants to, but part of the process is that there's a national principle which says that the Commission can't take account of your actual policies and decisions around the chamber. It's the effort neutrality principle. So that's in the information you've got. So the Commissioner specifically excluded from taking account of the individual decisions that you make. The assessment process takes into account an average level of service based on a standard bucket of services from the information you give us out of your financial statements. Jane might also say on occasion that perhaps your effort is your own reward and that your costs in relation to how you manage your waste are lower than perhaps some other councils have to incur due to reasons such as having to cart waste to different distances or many distances in terms of not having landfill sites or not managing their waste as well as you do. So it's a fair point, but I think the Commission would say that it's appropriately taken into consideration in its current assessment process.
That's the point. Do you want to add anything? Sorry, since you've been verbal.
I think Peter spoke very well for me. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
But we spend a lot of money on increasing longevity of that site down there, so we don't have to cut it long distances. So we are investing all the time into not having to cart our rubbish, like I said, up past Dublin.
And those costs that you incur are taken into consideration when we calculate the cost of waste management across the state. Okay. So they are taken into consideration. At the end of the day, that calculation for waste management and the rest of the calculations for the other services and your capacity to raise revenue still find you as a per capita minimum council.
With your waste facility, allowing other councils to use it, do you work on a cost recovery basis with those councils?
Even the methane that's captured on site is put into cogeneration and sold to the local community.
Mm. Good. Mm.
It's a joint enterprise, essentially.
Mm.
Another question, housing trust.
If it's to do with the grant.
Well, it is in terms of the NGOs coming into that field and getting into that industry where we may or may not get the same rate income going forward. We had a promise earlier that we all were excited about, but it doesn't seem like it's actually going to flow through as well as we would have liked. That's a significant loss for the council if it doesn't shore up. Will the Grants Commission take that into account going forward?
An excellent question. As you can imagine, I am across that in a serious way, and I've had conversations with my fellow commissioners. My understanding of that is that I would, so the commission is awaiting the outcome of the political process in terms of where Cabinet will land on that matter. And when there is finally a decision, we will look at the impact. We, the Commission, will look at the impact on local councils and whether that impact is even across councils. And I suggest that it probably won't be, that councils such as Marion, Playford, Onkaparinga, probably some regional councils will, like Port Augusta, for instance, will possibly be mostly impacted. And if that's the case, we'll certainly explore what options there are. So we have to wait to see where the process will end so that we can make an assessment at that point.
Yeah, it's a bit of a stitch up, really. I'd just like to ask the Commission, what should the City of Marion be doing in terms of the identified local government grants? And what recommendations would you give any other council for pushing the issue?
I think there's a number of factors here. I think the key one is that South Australia is historically disadvantaged because of the current arrangements. The supplementary road funding was always at the whim of government, and if you can recall, it actually followed electoral cycles. Every time just before an election, it was announced, and then it was announced for 2.5 years, and then they would wait again. Anyway, at some point in that scenario, you were going to get an environment where an incoming government would think that it would basically get rid of it, and, which it did. I mean, it was always the Commission's view, because we can't lobby government. We are a statutory authority. It was always our view, however, that unless the South Australian government and the LGA worked really hard to lock that in, that you would lose it, you as in South Australian local councils. So that's what's happened. So my advice, if there is any, that I could give, is that South Australian councils work either independently as an entity on their own or through the LGA or through the state government and through your local members, local federal members, to go back and readdress this issue. Because the issue, I mean, the problem for the Commission is always that the South Australian pie is not large enough. It's simply not. Any empirical evidence, any look at the numbers would tell you that we get less per capita, less per kilometre than other states. So we can argue with each other whether we take money away from Oruru Carrington and give it to Marion, just as an example. Or we can actually look at the bigger picture, the most important picture of all for us, from our perspective, which is to grow the pie. Because that's fundamentally, we've not got enough money to divide. So all of you are getting less and less, and we're kind of, the squabbling between us almost is pointless because the pie is so small. So I think that that's the issue. I think in terms of the distribution, we do the best we can.
If I could add to that, I agree with the Chair. The reason that South Australia gets a disproportionately large share of the Roads Recovery Fund is because we did that as a collective group, lobbied the Commonwealth Government. So out of the Roads Recovery, we still get 8.33%, which is still not as high as what we were hoping for, but nevertheless, it's much better than the 5.5%. So it is successful if the impetus is there to continue to voice our concerns.
Thank you. The question. Well, there being none, I sincerely thank you for coming along, and thank you all for contributing. I think just about all of us have learned a lot more about it, to be honest. So that really was useful. Thank you. While the members of the Grants Commission are leaving, I'd just like to acknowledge a couple of people in the gallery. Welcome to some of the leading lights, the Friends of Glenthorne, who are observing our proceedings with interest, and also to our future Chief Executive, Mr. Adrian Scull, who's observing this evening. What we're going to do now
should have a motion to note the presentation or note the report. Note the presentation. Move Councillor Hull, second Councillor Fryer. All those in favour? All against? That goes unanimously. Thank you. So now we're not quite getting back on track. We're dogs bylaw, page 17 of the agenda. So, look, since Councillor Hutchinson has briefly stepped out of the room, he might have put on his own hat for a moment. We'll deal with reports, which appear page 25 onwards in the agenda. There are the reports from Mayor, Deputy Mayor, Mayor and elected members. And I do note with interest the Chief Executive Officer report, and I thought I might put Mr. Whitbread on the spot, because when one looks at those meetings listed on page 27, I just wonder if the Council might be interested in hearing a very brief précis of the issues that were discussed. If it is appropriate to advise us at this point.
No, I'm happy to do that on the 18th. I didn't mean it's the first I've seen of this.
I think. You met with various people, but there is an elected members forum coming up on the 18th of August.
We're
going to discuss some of those issues then.
Yes,
right, yeah, thank you.
The 15th of July, the meeting with Luigi Rossi. Is that in any way connected to any item on the agenda tonight?
No, it's not.
Okay.
Through the Chair. Staff did some preliminary investigations into this matter, and we spoke with Councillor Hutchins as well, in that there may be options for Council to achieve what you're seeking through this motion through resolutions rather than progressing with the processing with amending the bylaw. And given the bylaws were passed at the beginning of the year, that may be a more simple way to address this matter. And then when we come to reviewing the bylaws again, we would bring those changes in. Yep. So, through the Chair, really the only change we've used the same words with the amended motion from Councillor Hutchins, but the only change is that we could bring the report back to Council first before commencing changes to the bylaw.
Councillor Hutchinson, can I ask your intention in relation to the motion and the suggested wording?
Yeah, look, following the previous meetings and the forum that we had, I came up with the motion on page 23. Subsequently, staff went through that and said, well, hang on, there might be a better way forward without having to amend the bylaw, which still achieves the same outcome, which is where we're nominating where these dog exercise areas actually are. And basically, they've put forward that they can prepare a report on that, which is essentially what we wanted. them to do as part of that process, but it just narrows it down that we don't actually necessarily have to amend the bylaw itself. So I'm happy with page 24, but I'm just a little bit curious as to, given the procedural unfoldings of the evening, how that's going to work given that we adjourn the item. The problem is the seconder's not in the room this evening. Okay then, fantastic. Well, I'm happy to seek leave of the meeting to do so.
Westwood. Councillor Westwood, did you wish to speak to that? Other speakers to the debate? Question from Councillor Hull.
Link in our proposed off-leash areas into this report. Is it possible to actually embed that in the report with the proposed off-leash areas? One in the north, one in the south, as I understand it.
Ms Dixon.
Through the chair. So is Councillor Hull referring to a previous resolution passed by council with the two dog parks? So though that is separate to this motion, but that is a motion that council passed in terms of a report will be needed to bring to brought to council. When that motion was passed, my understanding is there is no funds currently allocated to that. There is also work being done with the dog park on Reserve Road in the south, so that would address that previous motion, but there's also the facility in the north of the city, so that will need to be brought back to council.
So I think the question was whether the report that is called for by the motion to come back to council, is that going to include reference to the Trot Park and Glengowrie reserves?
So...
No? Yes? I beg your pardon. So a north and a south site, whatever they may be.
So through the chair, we can include that in the report brought back to council.
Thank you. I think there were some confusions, and thank you, members, for bearing with us through the understandings of what some of these terms are, and a dog exercise area is exactly that. It's where a dog may be exercised off leash. So it would be great if those potential new sites could also be identified. Because what we are talking about are two issues. A dog park is an area where we dedicate a zone and fence it off, and it has certain aesthetics around that. A dog exercise area is our local reserves. Currently, and we want to identify where we see that being more appropriate and where potential dog-free spaces might be, particularly around in certain areas, just to give people the choice in terms of which reserve they may choose to picnic in or play sport in or whatever it might be. So it's about giving the community choice, and it's also about making it a lot clearer in our minds where it's appropriate for dog exercise areas. That's all it is. I hope everyone's in support of that.
policy being developed in relation to enforcement, not just in relation to dogs, but other issues as well, so that council will have the opportunity to consider the appropriate strictness or otherwise of enforcement across the city in a whole range of areas. So you can see how that will tie in to what happens in this dogs in open spaces field. I'll now put the motion. All those in favour, please raise your hand. All those against, that's carried unanimously. Thank you, members. We can now go on to page 29 of the agenda concerning the Crown Development application for removal, etc., of regulated trees, those beautiful gum trees on Sturt Road and other places. Councillor Telfer to move.
I've got some alternative words to bring. The reason I'm bringing these is because DIPTI have not come down and briefed us appropriately. So rather than us workshopping in the dark for 15, 20 minutes tonight, it's better that DIPTI come and explain clearly what they're doing and why they're doing it. So I'll bring these motions forward. One is that you note the material in the report. The second is that to actually appropriately respond to the application, the applicant, that is DIPTI, meets with us as soon as possible for a forum and discusses this development application. And thirdly, in order to seek this information, we need to put off the closing date of the 21st of August so that we are quite clear what we are saying to DAC, but not having been briefed appropriately by DIPTI, we don't have the context in which to work. So I'll so move.
Is that seconded? Yes, Councillor Pfeiffer.
Thank you, Your Worship. Yeah, look, I must admit, in reading this report, I'm absolutely gobsmacked by this. Absolutely gobsmacked. It's, look, I accept that in the immediate vicinity of the new roadway and the new carriageway, yeah, there is a minority of trees that will have to go, and I accept that. That's fine. But some of these trees are being removed for what's called temporary pavement. A, we're chopping down trees that are a couple of hundred years old for temporary pavement. Some of these trees are 700 metres away from the road. They're in a different suburb. They are literally in a different suburb. It's mind-blowing. And I refer to one such tree, and this one particular tree is not actually one that is scheduled for removal, rather a major prune. But it's on the corner, and most people here would know it, it's on the corner of McInerney Avenue on Sturt Road. It's got a 7.3 metre diameter trunk. That's double what's required to be a regulated tree. Double. 7.3 metres. That's massive. It's a massive, massive tree. And it would have absolutely been here since before European settlement. It's astonishing that we're just hacking away at such amazing natural assets within our city. We're talking about urban heat island effect. We're talking about, you know, in our own environmental management. It's just absolutely astonishing that we're, you know, looking to chop down all our trees and put them in a tree museum, as Joni Mitchell would have said. You know, it's I can't believe that any government authority would actually consider this. So yeah, look, I'm absolutely with Councillor Telfer on this, and I think we need to push back as hard as possible.
Councillor Hull,
I'll ask a question. DIPTI came and briefed us not all that long ago in the ante room over there, committee room. I'd like to know whether the staff in the room could advise whether DIPTI knew about those trees and the Sturt Road widening at the time, as was the case with the widening of the road that was going to impact on Warrapringa. So I'd like to know whether it's reasonable for me to think that DIPTI actually knowingly came and briefed us and withheld that information. That's my question.
first time we were aware of this was when we received this application, which was on the 16th of June, I think it was.
Okay, so supplementary question is, the forum that they came to brief us on was on what day? I'm just doing a bit of detective work here. You know, I think we're starting to see a picture that they would have known clearly with their advanced planning, with their strategic planning, that those trees would have been at risk. And that's the point that I'm making. I just have a question for the mover and the seconder. If they would consider changing the motion to actually have DIPDI come to a council meeting rather than a council forum. The reason I ask that question, Mr. Mayor, is that tonight we had the EPA come here for an issue of great public interest. This is of great public interest, and I just ask whether the mover and seconder would consider changing the motion to actually ask them to come along in a public meeting, on a proper council meeting, to actually brief us in this forum, not in a closed-door setting.